Blog Talk Radio.
In the beginning was the beat, and the beat was the rhythm of God, and the rhythm of God is the harmony of humanity, and where there is harmony, there is peace.
And yes, we are the drum. Greetings, family, and welcome to another edition of Dare to Win. Tonight, we're going to be exploring the question, why is the forming of the United African States key to African liberation and sovereignty? How are the struggles of brothers and sisters in the Caribbean connected to the struggles of brothers and sisters in North America? We will explore these and other questions on tonight's Dare to Win. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. And greetings, family, and welcome to another edition of Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us Economic Development Cooperative LLC weekly Thursday night broadcast, coming to you live on Blog Talk Radio. Dare to Win is where we have a sobering conversation about the economic, political plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global cooperative economic machinery that will free our people and put us on the road to self-determination and sovereignty. To join tonight's conversation, call 929-477-2789. Then press the number 1 on your keypad. We will see your hand in the studio and open your phone line for your comments or questions. Also, you can visit our webpage at usliftingus.com. That is U.S. liftingus.com. Click on the Uulu Radio tab, then click on Listen Live. My name is Brother Kimbizi. I'm one of the founding board members of Us Lifting Us, and I will be your host for this evening's broadcast. And once again, I am very excited. Joining me on the line tonight is Brother Felipe Nogueira, international business consultant, global trade negotiator, and coordinator of the Caribbean region of the Pan-African Federalist Movement. We began the conversation last week and ran out of time, and Brother Nogueira was gracious enough to return to our airwaves this evening to give us part 2 of last week's conversation. Good evening, Brother Nogueira. How are you feeling this evening?
Good evening, Brother Kibisi. I'm fine, thank you, and good evening to all your listeners out there. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm feeling fine and happy to be with you.
And we're glad to have you. Share a little of your own story, where you're from and how you came to be the Caribbean coordinator of the Pan-African Federalist Movement.
Well, I'm from Trinidad. Actually, I was born in New York, but I went to Trinidad as a little boy, and I spent most of my adult life there. I was educated in the United States, at least my high school and university graduate school. But I've spent most of my life in the Caribbean. I've lived in Tanzania, in South America, Venezuela. And how I came to be, I've always been involved in, you know, going back to my years at Harvard, I was a leader of the anti-apartheid movement. And then I studied, while I was there, I studied Mandarin and Kiswahili. And then I went and lived for a year in Tanzania where I taught martial arts called Kujilinda in Kiswahili and worked with the Ujamaa villages. This is back in the days of Mwalimu, President Julius Nyerere. And so this is in the late 70s. So I had a chance to work closely with the liberation movements of Southern Africa. And when, actually I was going to stay, but my father and brother convinced me to go back to the United States and continue my education. And when I did, I worked, we organized in 1979. If your listeners can Google Amandla, the Festival of Unity. That was a benefit concert for the liberation movements and for refugees of the war in Southern Africa. So this took place at Harvard Stadium. We had Bob Marley and the Wailers, Patti LaBelle, Eddie Palmieri, Olatunji, the original Olatunji from Nigeria, the master drummer, the legendary drummer, Babatunde Olatunji. We had a group from South Africa called Jabula. We had the Art of Black Dance and Music from Boston. And our MC was none other than the great Dick Gregory. And we were able to raise money at a critical time and support ZANU, ZAPU, SWAPO, ANC, and PAC. So that, you know, really cut teeth. And actually, I have to give some credit to the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Kwame Ture, also known as the great, late Stokely Carmichael. We became close comrades. They had actually invited me to witness the African Liberation Day concert that they organized about 2 months before the Amandla concert. And that was so impressive with Peter Tosh, Leti Mbulu, Hugh Masakela, Gil Scott-Heron. So you just hear the names and you know what we're talking about. And so this was the tradition that I was fortunate enough to come out of. I also attended the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, where I studied Arabic and international economics. And then I went to a school called the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, where I did international communications law. And I'm very interested and very keen on the theme of ULU, of your organization and what you're trying to do, because it's very much in keeping with the whole Marcus Garvey political economy movement, that in order to be truly liberated, we have to be united. And in order to be united, we have to be able to feed ourselves. We have to be able to control our own economic life. And we've seen throughout history, from the time that our ancestors were captured on the continent of Africa and brought as prisoners of war, they call us slaves, but that is only because they won that particular war and they extracted labor from us. If you don't mind, let me give you a little poem that I wrote some time ago. It was translated into several languages by the Pan-African Federalist Movement, but it's consistent with the poem that I heard at the beginning of the show. And it goes,
go right ahead.
A ripple trails across my mind, an infinite sea toward a faint light beckoning, reassuring that our people must be free. An African people, once mighty and proud, then captured, enslaved, beaten until our heads bowed low and heavy from oppression and shame, losing all but our God, losing even our names. 400 years upon years without end. We've come down a hard road, still full of pitfalls and broken spirits to mend. But replacing prudence from ignorance and fear, we'll move onward and forward until victory is here. That is basically, I think, consistent with what you are trying to accomplish. Going back to the story, so my master's thesis was on a regional satellite system for Southern Africa, which would combine communications with meteorological and remote sensing, so that as to assist the, at the time, liberation movements of Southern Africa in being able to monitor some of the troop movements of the South African Defense Force, the apartheid regime's military, and that was some of the my academic background. What we were able to do, or what I was able to do, working with a brother by the name of Noah Samara, Ethiopian Sudanese brother. I'm fast forwarding now. I was the founding Secretary General of the Caribbean Association of National Telecommunication Organizations. So I won a Fulbright Fellowship. I advised the Venezuelan government back in 1982 on their satellite systems, and then went back to Trinidad, where I worked as a strategic planning manager for a telecommunications company. And then we formed this group called CANTO, which was basically dedicated to the proposition at the time of ending telecolonialism. Telecolonialism is where the means of communication are controlled by outsiders. I won't call them imperialists. I won't call them racists, although they are. But their basic aim is to maintain control of our means of communication because, as you know, and this medium helps to inform our listeners, that when we can control our own communications, we are able to relate to one another without interruption, without interpretation. Just a quick example, when Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah went to meet Patrice Lumumba in what should have taken an hour and a half flight, it took 7 hours because the flight, the pilot was a CIA agent. When they began, when they met to talk, instead of speaking an African language, whether Wolof or Sirir or Kiswahili, they had to speak. One was speaking English, the other speaking French, and of course, as the Italians say, traduttore traidore, the translator was a traitor. And this is so whether we're talking about electronic communications or interpersonal communications, we have to be able to control our own communications. And so going back to the story of Noah Samara, I met him, I heard about him in 1990 in Zimbabwe. I was there for the first ITU conference. We'll go back further, 1985. I had just, as a young man, been appointed Secretary General of CANTO, and I had to arrange a meeting between the, there was the first World Telecommunications Development Conference taking place in Arusha, Tanzania. And I had to arrange the travel for the Minister of Communications at the time in Trinidad, along with the delegation. And I found that every time I was calling Tanzania, I had to be routed through Europe. And I asked myself, and since I'd studied this, I said, why in the age of direct broadcast satellites, where one space segment covers a third of the Earth's surface, do I need to be going north in order to get south? Why can't we do south-south? So when I went to Tanzania and I mentioned that to my senior, he said, don't mention that to anybody except the Minister of Communications from Tanzania, a man by the name of John Malecela, who later became the president of Tanzania. I went to him and he looked at me and he was a big man, well, maybe 6'7". He took me by the hand like a little boy and took me to this white lady, white American lady by the name of Heather Hudson, and said, this man has some important things to tell you. So I, of course, was distrustful. I don't know, Mzungu, I don't know what to say with this lady. So I said, can you tell me what the traffic volumes are like between Latin America and the Caribbean on one hand and Africa and the Middle East on the other? She said, why do you want to know that? I said, I'm curious. She said, you're interested in south to south, aren't you? I said, well, doesn't it make sense? Well, she was progressive, so she said, you're damn right it makes sense. You know how much money these countries lose because of the circuitous routing to go north in order to get back to the south. And that set me on a lifelong odyssey of finding almost like the missing link where we could communicate with each other directly. And I won't, so I, the next part of that story is in 1990 in Zimbabwe when I hear that Noah Samara is wants to launch South Africa's first satellite, but he can't get a license from the FCC. So he's introduced to me. I said, why do you want to go to the FCC, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, in order to get a license to launch a satellite for Africa? He said, well, you know, I need a license from somebody. I said, come to Trinidad. I'll get you a license. And within 2 years, I was able to help. No, that was, you know, 9 years. Yeah, within 2 years, we were able to get him a license. And a few years later, I was invited by the International Telecommunications Union to Malaga, Spain, Torremolinos, to speak to issues of concern to developing countries. I was the keynote speaker. And I said, look, Noah, I have a chance to make a plea on behalf of, you know, the developing countries. And yours is the most progressive and most advanced proposal. At the time, the United States and Canada, no, it was the U.S. And Europe wanted to use, I don't want to get too technical, but the Ku band, which is very high up in the frequency band, for more intelligence and military purposes. But there were orbital slot positions reserved for developing countries. So we coordinated, I made the plea, and we were able, and because the ITU, like the United Nations, actually the ITU is the oldest international organization, having been formed in the late 1800s, we were able to get all the developing countries and some developed countries such as Canada and New Zealand to vote on behalf of WorldSpace, which was Noah's company. And that's how Africa was able to launch, to get the frequencies and the orbital slot positions to launch its first satellite, AfriStar. If you look it up, you'll see AfriSpace and AfriStar were designed and developed by Noah Samara. And that was quite an accomplishment. However, that was doing
Brother Nagera.
Yes, sir.
Brother Nagera.
Go ahead.
You have such a rich background, and a very impressive background. So let me pose this question to you, and as you answer it, then pull in the pieces that help flesh out the story a little bit. I want to pick up where we left off last week, and we were looking at why is the formation of the United African States critical to African liberation and sovereignty in your view?
Okay. So to answer, I'll be a little circuitous to get to the question. So just to complete the contextual background. So
okay.
In 1994, I was asked by Colonel Otafiri and President Museveni to come to represent Trinidad and Tobago at the 7th Pan-African Congress in Kampala, Uganda. I led the Trinidad and Tobago delegation, and I was asked by Brother Dudley Thompson, because I'm also Jamaican through my mother, to be his deputy for the Jamaican delegation. So effectively, we had a very tightly run, knit Caribbean participation. And at that meeting were people, I mean, some of them have joined the ancestors. Kwame Ture was there. John Garang from Sudan. Might know this name, Mohamed Farah Aidid from Somalia, and many others, Sister Gracia Machel. And we had some very, very powerful resolutions and even were offered citizenship. Actually, we were able to travel between Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania without any passport, which is how it should be. We only had our conference IDs, and it was an amazing, amazing event. I won't go into all of the kind of serendipitous things that happened. But why I'm giving you this is because even though, and I'm talking about the global Pan-African movement, goes back 100 years to 1901, the first Pan-African Congress was organized by a Trinidadian lawyer named Henry Sylvester Williams. The second, third, and fourth were organized by the great Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. And then the 5th Pan-African Congress was organized again by two other Trinidadians, C.L.R. James and George Padmore. And a quick story, George Padmore was he had been probably one of the most powerful and prominent African people at that time, having been in charge of the developing countries in the Comintern, but he fell out with Joseph Stalin over the issue of Pan-Africanism. And so he was being chased by both Stalin and Hitler and managed to get to London in time to host, to organize the fifth Pan-African Congress in Manchester, England at the time. The sixth Pan-African Congress was held in 1974 in Tanzania, and that was the first time it was ever held on the African continent. And even though the focus was on the liberation movements of Southern Africa, and this comes to the other question you were asking, it also, the neocolonial elements in the Caribbean isolated people like Maurice Bishop, the leader of the New Jewel movement of Grenada, later became the Prime Minister of Grenada. People like Kafra Kambon and Makandal Daga from Trinidad, Walter Rodney from Guyana, a number of were isolated and unable to participate in the sixth Pan-African Congress. So the seventh was very important. But the problem was that after the meeting, the follow-up was missing. And what we were, even though this was a move ahead of the African, the OAU at the time, which later became the African Union, it was still a meeting of intellectuals and that type of people, and without the ability to implement and follow up. So there was nearly a 20-year hiatus. We began to agitate for an organization of the 8th Pan-African Congress around 2012, right after Colonel Gaddafi was killed and taken out, and Libya went from being the richest and the highest standard of living of Africans to what the squalor that is Libya now, where African people are enslaved and being sold. And we just heard some horrible news a few weeks ago where they were found human farms with men, women, children, and babies in cages, and more horrific than anything we could imagine, removing and harvesting their organs from over $1 billion in cash. It's in that context that the Pan-African Federalist Movement emerged as a grassroots effort to organize African people around the world with the specific and focus and goal of creating the United African States in a single generation or less. So I'm sorry for being so long-winded, but I wanted to give you all a historical context to see where this movement has emerged from, and the fact that it is a grassroots movement, that all of the regions of Africa, North, South, Central, East, and West, as well as the Caribbean, North America, South America, Europe, Asia, East Asia, and Australia, are a part of this movement. I have the honor of being the coordinator for the Caribbean, and in the Caribbean we have Antigua, Barbuda, Barbados, Belize, Cuba, Dominica, Haiti, Guyana, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, and the Virgin Islands, 10 active, and Guyana, and members. And we meet on a monthly basis. There was an African Liberation and African Liberation Day, which took place on the 25th last week, was celebrated by these different chapters, if I will, around the world. Again, with this focus, and what we attempt to do is to tie in the struggles that we are facing as African people, whether it's in South America, where our leaders are being killed, African leaders are being killed in order for their land to be seized. Or the Caribbean, where we've been suffering from as victims of meteorological warfare, from Hurricane Maria and other types of atrocities that are being used to depopulate in order to seize land, to the issues that the Black Lives Matter movement confronts in the United States in terms of basically, I won't say genocide, but a deliberate pattern of what they call justifiable homicide, of killing unarmed, most of the time, African men and women, and doing so with impunity at the hands of police officers. So on one hand, we have this overarching objective to establish the United African States and are focusing on that. We held our first pre-Congress in December of last year in Ghana, in Accra, Ghana, with the daughter of Kwame Nkrumah, Samia Nkrumah, as one of the patrons. And our aim is to hold the first Pan-African Federalist Congress in Mali, in Bamako, in December of 2020, at which time we will do the work that's starting, that has already begun, the agitation, the mobilization of our young people to inform and educate and empower, so that the creation or the bringing into being of the United African States will be by popular acclaim, using referenda, using modern technology such as apps to be able to conduct polls, surveys, and referenda that will help our people to empower themselves. This is, as far as I know, unprecedented. Even the late, great Marcus Mosiah Garvey, who built the largest an international organization of African people, the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, 100 years ago, was taken out before, even in spite of the Black Star Line, in spite of the African, the Negro World Press, was taken out and put in prison in Atlanta for mail fraud. So we have to be very careful, in fact, more than careful, we have to be impeccable with how we move in order to be able to accomplish our objectives. We are not identifying any enemies except those who try to prevent our unity. And therefore, the question of unity is paramount. And unity does not mean uniformity. It does not mean that everybody has to look at the world the same way. It does mean that we have to prioritize the unity and unification of our people. So the United African States, as distinct from the United States of Africa, it will include the African states of the Caribbean, of Latin America, even the populations of concentrated Africans in North America and Europe, where referenda are taken, where constituent assemblies are taken, and plebiscites are taken, and people by democratic will say, we want to adhere to this geopolitical entity where we are protected, where we are represented, which includes trade, culture, spirituality, and, of course, political empowerment.
Well, thank you for that history lesson. Thank you for putting all of this in a global context so that our listeners can better grasp the argument that is fundamental to everything that you said and that we often say from these airways, that as a people we must have a framework where we are united economically and politically, because 54 or 57 separate African countries simply cannot protect itself from the marauders and the predators that continue to extract the wealth and wreak all kinds of havoc among our people. So, what I'm thinking in terms of now, you've laid out a very clear understanding for us about why this United African States leads then to genuine liberation. And then to actual sovereignty, where we can begin to harness the tremendous amount of wealth that is African people and the African continent and places where we are, where we live, and control those spaces. Certainly, the countries of the Caribbean and as you mentioned, the very large populations of Africans outside of the continent in North America, South America, and as well as Europe. We're witnessing the rise of a very virulent white nationalism in this country, as evidenced by the president, the current president, but similar movements are sweeping across the European continent as well. And it is easy for black people in North America and the Caribbean to view our struggles as isolated and disconnected. What are some of the commonalities between the struggles of our people in the Caribbean and the struggles for black people in North America. How do you see these connected? And we'll get started on that question, and then we're going to take a music break and let you finish up answering on the other side of the break. So initially, what would you say in terms of commonalities that you see between our sisters and brothers in the Caribbean and the struggles of sisters and brothers in North America? How are these struggles connected?
Well, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with a one of our most beloved Calypsonians from Trinidad and Tobago. His name is Leroy Calise, but better known in the Calypso world as the Black Stallion. He sang a song which won him his first Calypso crown called Caribbean Man, where he sang, "We took the same trip on the same ship." And in other words, we were doing our business. Africa was a united, well, was one, it was, we only became 50 some odd states when the Europeans in 1884, led by King Leopold II of Belgium, sat down around the around a table and took all those colonialists from England, France, Portugal, Spain, Germany, and who else?
Italy.
Those are the main, those are the principal culprits, and they divided up Africa among themselves. So the sovereignty of which we speak is not the sovereignty of Angola or South Africa or Ghana or Guinea or Tanzania. It's the sovereignty of Africa and African people. And so the commonality is a common historic experience. We were snatched. We were taken to different places and sold as but fighting all the way. Fighting all the way, and we wouldn't stop fighting until they went to the Germans and said, "What are we going to do with these children of the Songhai Empire?" I said, "Children of the Songhai Empire? Well, you got to tell them that they're not children of the Songhai Empire. As long as they know that they're children, they're descendants of Mali and Ghana and Zimbabwe and Songhai, they're going to resist. You have to tell them that they're Negroes. What is a Negro? Well, if your grandfather came from India, they call you an Indian. If they came from China, you'd be Chinese. If you came from Europe, European. But where is Negro land? There's no such thing." So they tried to make us think that our history begins in 1619 in Jamestown or wherever it was that they brought us up on the shores in chains, and that's where we start. That's even at Harvard, they taught African-American or Afro-American history. But our history goes, it's the beginning of time. It's where humanity began. It's where civilization began. But by robbing us of that knowledge, we are forced into this compartmentalization. When we look at the educational system now, we're being prepared. We're preparing our youth, dumbing down the educational system, the curriculum, in order to go and work in McDonald's and KFC and these fast food joints, rather than to become nuclear scientists or painters and poets and philosophers. And therefore, our historical experience is very, very similar. Whether we work on tobacco plantations in Virginia or sugar plantations in Cuba. It was the same people, same ship, just different same trip, just maybe a different ship at a different time. So our commonality lies in our ancient history, in our more recent history, and in our current predicament as the only way that we can really exert our genuine human rights is through the exercise of sovereignty. And the only way we can exercise sovereignty is when we understand that commonality and that there is a solution that we all have at our fingertips.
Okay, brothers, Felipe, we're going to take a quick music break, and I'll let you finish that thought on the other side of the break. And we're back. Welcome again to Dare to Win, Us Lifting Us, Economic Development Cooperative's weekly radio broadcast. My name is Brother Kimbizi, and we are having a fascinating conversation with Brother Felipe Nogueira, who is the Caribbean Regional Coordinator for the Pan-African Federalist Movement. And he has been giving us just an amazing historical journey through our struggle as a people and how we find ourselves separated and isolated in North America, in the Caribbean, in South America, on the continent of Africa, divided and unable to come together and work as a collective. Brother Felipe, you finished the thought that you were on as we talked about the commonality of the struggles between sisters and brothers in the Caribbean and brothers and sisters in North America.
Thank you. I recommend a song by Peter Tosh, who says, "No matter where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. So if you come from Zimbabwe, or if you come from Brooklyn, or if you come from Trinidad, you're a black man, you're an African. Don't mind your complexion, you must have the direction of an African." So while they're dumbing down education, they are ramping up artificial intelligence. You're seeing the public education funds being taken away. They have a cretin in power named Betsy DeVos, who is responsible for education, and she's trying to remove public funds from public education into charter schools. And without any apology and without any analysis of what's happening to our people. And it's in this context that the Pan-African Federalist Movement moves forward. And on a monthly basis, we communicate with each other not only to provide updates on what's happening with our people and what's happening with our movement. And again, I stress the word movement as distinct from political party, where parties have, you know, a strict line of everybody has to be kind of uniform in their philosophy and their belief. How can you do that when you're also encouraging entrepreneurship, cooperative economics, Ujima, and some of the other principles that you mentioned? These are vital for us. We have to be able to make our education solution-oriented. It has to emphasize critical thinking, and it must be rooted in the African philosophy. And when I say must be, in order to have this authenticity and historical continuity in Ubuntu, the philosophy that says, "I am because you are," and in Ma'at, where we're talking about truth, peace, righteousness, love, balance. Balance not only among human beings, but balance between humans, humanity, and nature. And we're seeing a philosophy where the current controllers of the world are denying scientific reality, things like climate change and global warming that are affecting areas like the Caribbean that you can see. When I was a little boy and I went to a beach called Cedros, there was a lighthouse. Today you can barely see the top of the lighthouse because of rising sea levels, and that lighthouse is almost completely submerged by the sea. Not only islands like the Caribbean, but everybody on the eastern and western seaboard of North America is going to be faced with major catastrophic changes. And this is not from weapons like HAARP, but this is simply from the wanton despoliation of the environment that we are seeing. So that our liberation struggle is not only to exercise our self-determination. It is also to save the planet and the humans and the animal life on it, so that our future generations will still be around and can say, okay, at least they did something to look out for and to protect us.
Right. You raise a whole nother issue that I want to touch on in just a minute. But again, this conversation is certainly open to everyone on the line to join the conversation, to ask a question, to make a comment. Call 929-477-2789 and press the number 1 on your keypad. That will raise your hand. We will see you in the studio, and we will come to you, open your line, and allow you to ask your question or make your comment. You know, you mentioned the global warming and how that's impacting the global South. What island did you mention that the lighthouse is almost completely submerged?
That's in Trinidad, the south of Trinidad.
That's in Trinidad.
An area called Cedros, which is actually about 7 miles from Venezuela. And we're having a serious crisis taking place right now because of the economic pressure and political pressure being put on the government of Maduro, Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. We're having thousands of people flooding into Trinidad from Venezuela, some of them legitimate refugees because, when I say legitimate, economic hardship, hard to get basic commodities, toilet paper, medicine. But that's because of a deliberate blockade. This is a result of economic sanctions. It's not that that the government, that Mr. Trump, cares anything about the Venezuelan people. The guy who they were calling a president a few weeks ago, Guaido, now they're calling him the opposition leader. Nothing has changed except that his effort to try and cause a coup just flopped, because not only did the military not back him, the people didn't back him. The media, and you know what's funny? When you look at Fox News and you look at CNN and the BBC and even NPR, one of the more progressive stations in the country, they're all running the same line. There's nobody
giving
a different perspective about what's taking place in South America and in Venezuela. They're not saying anything about the dictator in Brazil or in so many other countries. Look at Saudi Arabia, what's taking place. Look at the devastation and the genocide taking place in Yemen. These are all phenomena that we have to contend with as we try and sort out our daily lives. How do we feed our families? How do we educate our children? How do we ensure that we are healthy, that we are eating properly, that we're exercising, that we have some kind of peace of mind to go about taking care of not only our daily business, but our strategic business as a people? And I wanted to say this, if I may, about the economic self-determination aspect. You talked about collective self-reliance, and it's something that I believed in for a long time. I remember back in the early 80s when they were killing our children in Atlanta and our sisters up in Boston. I took a trip from Boston down to Epps, Alabama. And in Epps, they had a group called the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. And we were trying to basically do trade among African communities in each from Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Alabama. But it was frustrated. And we're going to face a lot of frustrating and daunting challenges. Before he became president, Donald Trump said, if those African students continue to criticize me, all I got to do is unplug them. And you know what we're talking about. So it is an exigent imperative that we create our own means of communication. We're going to be doing very soon a GoFundMe to create our own global telecommunications system, which includes not only satellite but fiber optics, so that we've got some very, very sharp brothers and sisters working on the technology that's required. Of course, it requires a lot of capital, a lot of finance in order to be able to do this. But we often think that in order to do anything significant, we have to have millions and billions. Yeah, we do need millions and billions, but not necessarily millions and billions of dollars or gold bullion or even Lumi, which is one of the currencies that one of our people are coming up with that's going to be backed by solar energy. But millions and billions of red and white blood corpuscles working in harmony. And I think that all the people who are listening who have goodwill in their hearts and faith in our people and in themselves, because you must believe in yourself and in a benign creator, that is allowing a certain amount of – but until we can find a solution to bring ourselves together, we won't be able to sort out and overcome these obstacles. But once we do the kinds of things that you are doing, which is to reach and teach our people, and through doing so, unearthing the vast potential that we have to determine our own destinies, we can accomplish it. When Marcus Garvey said, arise, ye mighty people, and accomplish what ye will. he would, that is a powerful slogan that continues to be very true and very relevant to this day.
Absolutely. Underneath the political realities facing black people in the Caribbean and black people in North America, there is an economic reality. In your view and from your research, who would you say controls the economies of the Caribbean? How does that shake out? And are they the same forces that control the economies of North America?
The economy in North America and Europe. It's a very small elite, and they have their minions and their comprador representatives who ensure by engaging in corruption, in misallocation of resources. How else could you have? I mean, you say Caribbean, but I'm also including Africa because, you couldn't have. I don't know if your listeners know this, but about a month ago, the entire government of Burkina Faso resigned because it was uncovered that they had accepted a $40 million bribe from Bill Gates in order to release genetically modified mosquitoes that would make them cause infertility. We're facing genocide, and therefore the recognizing that the same people who are imposing harsh conditions of poverty and underdevelopment, lack of opportunities in this country, are the ones ensuring that that we do not have control of the resources in our own countries, that our misleaders are bribed and in the pockets, and they're putting all their money in Swiss and European and North American banks, and instead of reinvesting in the infrastructure and in services that will help to uplift the people in the Caribbean. It's unfortunately, yes, we have black governments, we have flags that say that we're nations, but the generation of people like Dr. Eric Williams and Barrow and Manley that saw the Caribbean as one nation, as a Caribbean union, it's only now being re-exerted. Actually, in Trinidad in August, the Assembly of Caribbean People, with a very similar organic grassroots base as the Pan-African Federalist Movement, will be meeting in Trinidad in order to, again, assess the fact that this neocolonial dependency that we have in the Caribbean is gotten rid of, and that we begin to exert autonomy and sovereignty in the control of our resources. Now, it's easier said than done, obviously, but when you have a mass of people finally being re-educated, we become a powerful and unstoppable force.
Wow. You said that was a bomb you just dropped when you mentioned the entire government of Burkina Faso
look it
resigning
up. Take my
because
word
they
for
took
it.
That.
Look it up.
We certainly will. We in Ulu see a clear need for an alternative economy to serve the basic needs of our people. And from our research, it's crystal clear that only a cooperative economy will free us from the clutches and the exploitation of this rapacious capitalism, imperialism, neocolonialism, free enterprise, market economy, whatever we want to call it. If Brother Shabaka is also on the line with us tonight, and I want to just ask him to come in at this point and say why we see this cooperative economic model is so vitally important to everything that we're talking about. Brother Shabaka, can you share from your perspective?
Yes, greetings, and thank you very much, Brother Kimbizi. Brother Felipe, greetings to you. Very good and informative presentation that you made, and we have a commonality because I used to be in the All African Revolutionary Party around the late 70s and 80s, so we may have crossed paths at one time or another. But very important question that you asked on the economic and how we see the economic flowing and how we see the foundation of that with cooperative economics. And cooperative economics is fundamentally what it means to cooperate economically. All right. And we keep that cooperating economically somewhat self-contained, but we have a little special click to it, and that's we throw the family economics, because we realize that when we look at on the African continent and throughout what we would call the developing world, how family-centered, and particularly a lot of centered around the black woman, how economics is shaped around that. So we see a family-centeredness in sustaining the economic growth of a community as being vital for those communities that are evolving. The capitalistic model breaks the family up. It takes you away from your mother, takes you away from your grandmother, sends you across country. Hopefully you try to get some resources back. After a while, you forget how resources are sending resources back to assist them. So the model in and of itself historically has not worked for our people. And ULU has a model that we have. We call it family-centered cooperative economics. And essentially what it means is nothing strange, because we have done it before in a number of communities during the segregation period when we were forced to segregate, developed, cooperated, and built an economy. And they built it so successfully. We know about Tulsa. We know about in areas in North Carolina, Northern Florida, and what have you, even Atlanta. Right, exactly. So we've seen these centers, and we know that there's a historical foundation in which we were able to build cooperative centers and flourish as a consequence of that. So we see ULU presenting a model that is no different than what we've done. In addition to that, it's no different than what we see ourselves participating in now. You can go to any black church in America. They have various number of ministries set up. Those ministries are funded by the people who attend those churches. They are motivated by their clergy, you know, to participate, to contribute. I mean, they go in their pockets and to contribute, because in their mind, they see that the contributions that they make is going to affect the ministries that have been set out and explained by their leadership, which in turn they feel will benefit them. And so what ULU is doing, what a cooperative economic family-centered is doing, is nothing different. We want the people in our community to come together, pool our resources instead of wasting our resources at the tune of over $1 trillion spending wildly each year. We want you to pool some of those resources together in creating, from pooling the resources, businesses that employ ourselves, all right, and that expand from horizontal to vertical, infrastructure to superstructure, and then from those resources, making sure that the surplus, or sometimes called profits, are redirected, not in my particular pocket, not in Brother Kimbizi's pockets, not necessarily in the pockets of Brother Felipe, but in all of our pockets, that we have an equitable means by which those resources are distributed. And for those organizations that have been philanthropic in assisting, we want to make sure some there so that it can continue to carry out their work. And all we ask you to do is to contact us. Brother Kimbizi earlier had mentioned how you might be able to contact us. It's just going to our website. And so we have three plans, you know, come together, pull our resources. Family-centered means that the foundation of it is family and community. Although we know we don't live in a community because we don't control it, more neighborhood-like, but the objective is to create communities and come together, pull our resources, think of the intergenerational aspect of passing those resources and wealth down as we pull our resources together. Identify to the best of our ability economic opportunities in which we can set up businesses. Make sure that those businesses are successful. And in their success, create wealth, profits, which then can be redistributed to the members of that community. Now, we haven't said anything about participation in government. We haven't said we had to go into the Democratic Party or Republican Party to pass laws. We know that the political, the foundation of the political, is your economic and your cultural base, which sets on how those politics can then in turn come back and support you. So this is Ulu. All you got to do is go to our website, join us, look at the information that we have there. We are expanding. We're going to be redoing our website soon to provide you with more information. You can contact us at the various numbers that Brother Kambizi had given to you. Brother Kambizi, I don't have it right offhand, but could you tell them the number that we have? The website is info@usliftinus.com, the contact number. Brother Kambizi, can you share that with the listening audience? I don't have it in front of me right now.
It's 404. Let me get it. I'll have it in just a second. I got all these other numbers, and I don't have that number, but I'll have it in just a flash.
Okay, well, while you're looking for that number, I don't have it either, but go to that. Look at the videos.
Is that the same number that I got from you, Brother Division? The 404 number?
404-592-2780. 404-592-2780 is our office number. So if you have a question and you just need some information, 404-592-2780. And then, of course, as Brother Shabaka mentioned, the website, usliftingus.com, usliftingus, all one word, .com. I didn't mean to cut you off, Brother Shabaka.
No, you're doing fine. Thank you so much for that. I just was looking at it. I don't have it here readily available, and I really appreciate you coming up with it. But as audience, family, as Brother Kambizi says, go there. We got a lot of stuff. We're not saying I want you to join blindly. We want you to examine what we have, critique what we have. We want you to use that number. We want you to use the email address if you have questions that you would like to offer that way. We want you to go through it, all right, and then give us feedback. But we feel that we have laid out a very successful plan and model, all right, that can transcend where you are, whether you are in Atlanta, Baltimore, Nairobi, Kinshasa, or wherever. All right, this is a model because it's family-centered and community-oriented. And where you found those places, we live in a family. We evolve from a family. That family lives in a community, all right, and share values. So, and this is all we're doing is sharing values, extending the economic arm. So we'd like you to go there, check this out. Membership in Ulu is just $50 annually. The second $50 is contributed towards your unit, which is something like a share, if you want. All right, one share is $1,000. May seem heavy, but we spend $1 trillion each year, so it's not too heavy for some people. All right, and we know that some people may have difficulties arriving at that, and we have various plans by which you can incrementally increase the amount of money that you participate so that you can share. The share gives you full ownership in Ulu. But to be have ownership in Ulu, you must first be a member. All right? And to be a member, you must be a person of Black African ancestry. That's a criteria to make sure that we keep what we have, what we collect in the family, and that we develop the family. No different than what the Chinese do, the Koreans do, and a lot of other
Arabs,
Jewish communities, you know.
Right.
Can I
Brother Shabaka, let me jump in. We have a caller.
Yeah.
Last four numbers,
okay.
0147. I'm going to open your line. Please tell us your name and where you're calling from. We have just a few minutes left, so we're going to 0147. Your line is open.
Good evening, Sharon Paris Chambers, Oshun, with the Caribbean
Initiating
Committee.
Greetings.
Yes, it's a
greetings.
It's a pleasure.
Greetings,
greetings to Brother Shimbaka, Brother Felipe Nugura, and you, Brother Kimbisi. It's a pleasure to listen to the program. It's very powerful and uplifting. I want to ask both the guests how important is the Caribbean as a zone of peace for the fulfillment of the mission of the PAFM, Pan-African Federalist Movement.
Would you restate your question, Sister Oshun, just so
how
we hear it clearly?
How important is the Caribbean as a zone of peace for the fulfillment of the mission of the sovereignty for the PAFM? Is there any relevance for the Caribbean to be a zone of peace, and how urgent is this at this time with the...
It's critical. It's critical.
Yes.
It's critical.
Brother Felipe, you want to jump on that?
Sure, I would. Just before I answer the question or address the question, I want to say to Brother Lumumba, I think we are copied on some correspondence from time to time from Brother Bob Brown from the AAPRP. But if it's not the same
yes.
Lumumba, then I apologize. And also, I agree with everything that you said. And I think that following this conversation, we should try to look at a close affiliation between the PAFM and its regional coordinator in North America, Brother Mwalimu Amsata, and yourself, because I see a close identity of what we're trying to accomplish.
Agreed.
Going to Sister Oshun's question, the notion of the Caribbean as a zone of peace was first raised by Maurice Bishop when there was talk about, you know, geopolitics entering into the Caribbean.
Good evening.
I mean, they were already... Cuba was already being isolated, and they were trying to do the same thing to Grenada. But people like Errol Barrow and Eric Williams reinforced that. The fact that the Caribbean, that Caribbean as a zone of peace means keeping out nuclear weapons, keeping out warfare. We have not had any significant military conflict in the Caribbean in its recent modern history. It's crucial, and it's crucial because to the extent that diplomacy, because we haven't talked about diplomacy very much, but to the extent that diplomacy is an effective means of political intervention, and it has worked in the past in the Caribbean, and to try to make it work again, it could also work as we move at the grassroots level in unifying African people on the continent and even in North America. So it presents, I think, a kind of a model that can be emulated in different parts of the African world. That's my contribution.
Thank you very much.
And thank you,
Sister
members. Oshun, for raising that question. Family, we're out of time.
Thank you so much.
So everyone knows, we had Sister Oshun and Brother Nagera, both deputy coordinator and coordinator of the Caribbean region for the Pan-African Federalist Movement. I want to thank Brother Shibaka for sharing with us also and working the controls tonight. And want to thank each of you for calling in, for being online with us. We'll be back next Thursday, 9 o'clock, same time, same station. In the meantime, go to usliftingus.com. Take a look at our information, as Brother Shibaka said. Critique it. Let us know what you think. If it makes sense and it resonates with your spirit, click the Join Now tab and become part of this movement. Until next week, stay black, stay strong. Peace, family.
Yes, sir. Woo.